Well, welcome, my friends, to The Catholic Reason, a radio production of St. Michael Catholic Radio based here in Broken Arrow, Oklahoma, where we think through various claims made by the Catholic Church concerning issues of faith, morality, and culture, and provide reasons behind those claims. I'm Dr. Carlo Broussard, staff apologist and speaker for Catholic Answers, and a member of the Chancery Evangelization Team here at the Diocese of Tulsa in Eastern Oklahoma. The Catholic Reason airs locally here in Tulsa every Thursday from 4 to 5 p.m. on St. Michael Catholic Radio 94.9 and 102.9. But you may be listening on your own local Catholic radio station at a different time, since the Catholic Reason is aired on other Catholic stations throughout the country. So if you're listening from outside the Tulsa area, welcome and thanks for joining me today. Note that you can download the show through whichever podcast platform you use by subscribing to the Eastern Oklahoma Catholic Podcast, and you can also access the archived episodes of the show at my website, carlobroussard.com, under the audio tab. And be sure to check out all the other great resources that I have there at my website, carlobroussard.com. Everything that I do for Catholic Answers is hosted there in one single location. So in today's episode, we're going to talk about miracles and specifically skeptical challenges to miracles, because miracles are a part and parcel of the Christian religion. They provide motives of credibility, as the Catechism of the Catholic Church puts it in paragraph 156, for believing in Jesus provides us motives of credibility. It makes belief in Christ and His church credible. But skeptics attempt to block such a motive for believing in Jesus by posing challenges to belief in miracles themselves. So it's sort of a priori argument. Rather than assessing the individual miraculous claims and trying to disprove those miraculous claims, some skeptics try to block the appeal to miracles from the outset, right out the gate, arguing that belief in miracles is something that an intellectually credible and sophisticated human being ought not to embrace. So in today's episode, we're going to look at some of these challenges, and three in particular. Number one, the claim that miracles violate the laws of nature. Number two, that no reasonable man should believe in miracles. That is to say, miracles is off limits for the wise, right? And then number three, the early Christians only believed in miracles because they lived in a primitive, pre-scientific culture where people were ignorant of the course of nature. My claim today is that these objections fail as justifiable reasons to reject belief in miracles. So let's start with the first objection. Miracles violate the laws of nature. They disprove science, how it is one way it's often phrased. Skeptics argue that miracles are impossible because the laws of nature are necessary. A miracle, they argue, involves a violation of a law of nature. But the laws of nature can't be violated, and so therefore miracles must be impossible. One modern skeptic of repute who argues this is Richard Dawkins. In his book, The God Delusion, he says miracles, by definition, violate the principles of science. So it's presented as if we have to make a choice between embracing or accepting miracles and science. And since we can't give up science, so the argument goes, we should be giving up miracles. Dawkins and other modern skeptics derive this argument from philosophers of note in the 17th and 18th centuries. For example, Baruch Spinoza, the 17th century Dutch philosopher, in his Tractatus Theologico-Politicus, chapter 6, he argues, if miracles are, strictly speaking, all above nature, then you must admit a break in the necessary and immutable course of nature, which is absurd. In the 18th century, Scottish skeptic philosopher David Hume wrote in his An Inquiry Concerning Human Understanding in section 10, a miracle is a violation of the laws of nature. There you have it. Dawkins just simply repeating Hume here. And as a firm and unalterable experience has established these laws, the proof against a miracle, from the very nature of the fact, is an entire as any argument from experience can possibly be imagined. So the bottom line here is that miracles entail the violation of the laws of nature. And since we can't adopt any idea that would entail the violation of the laws of nature, we must reject miracles. So how are we to respond to such an objection? Well, one response is to challenge the understanding of a miracle as a violation of the laws of nature. Now, in order to understand why miracles don't violate the natural order that God has created, it's necessary to understand what laws of nature are. Laws of nature are not mere descriptions of causal regularities, like, for example, when A, then B, that a miracle would disprove. The laws of nature rather express what things are capable of exhibiting by virtue of their inherent causal tendencies or dispositions. In other words, the laws of nature are descriptive of what objects are capable of producing given the powers that they have in virtue of their nature. So, for example, the law of nature that tells us water freezes at 32 degrees Fahrenheit is simply a description of the nature of water having a tendency or a disposition to freeze when the temperature reaches 32 degrees. The law of nature that tells us fire burns is a description of the inherent power fire possesses given its nature. The laws of nature, therefore, describe laws of nature's essences with inherent dispositional properties that manifest themselves when certain conditions are met. One could say the phrase laws of nature is shorthand for speaking about causal powers inherent in the nature of things. Dr. Edward Fazer has done some great work on this and in articulating the laws of nature in this way. So this is not something original to me. I just wanted to make that disclaimer there. So it's this understanding of the laws of nature that allows one to see how miracles are not violations of the laws of nature, proving a law to be false, and thus not a violation of the natural order set for us by God. Miracles are extraordinary sensible effects wrought by God that surpass, not violate, but surpass the power and order of created nature. Miracles are occurrences that can be brought about only by God's direct causal activity and not by natural forces operative in created objects. As such, a miracle doesn't prove a law of nature to be false, but simply indicates a cause beyond the natural causal powers of a thing is at work. That's what a miracle is proving. Not that the natural powers are false or that the principles of science are violated, but it simply indicates a cause beyond the natural causal powers of a thing is at work, and such a causal power is divine. So, for example, the natural forces operative in a human body cannot produce the effect of the body rising anew in living health after it's died. But God can produce such an effect by directly giving life to a dead body. And when he does this, as he did in the case of Jesus, or as Jesus did in the case of Lazarus, it doesn't disprove the law of nature that states that dead bodies stay dead. It still remains true that dead bodies have no inherent power to come back to life. God can also suspend an inherent power from manifesting itself without proving a law of nature to be false. Consider, for example, the miracle involving Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in Daniel 3. The fire into which they were thrown didn't burn them. Does this disprove the law of nature that states fire burns? No. God simply willed that the inherent power of fire not manifest itself in this particular situation. Fire still retains its natural tendency or disposition to burn, and thus the law of nature involving fire remains valid. That particular miracle in no way violates the principles of science or violates the laws of nature. God has not only the power to suspend an object's inherent disposition from manifesting itself, but also the power to give an object a new property it doesn't have by nature. Jesus' miracle of walking on water is an example of this, as recorded by Matthew in Matthew chapter 14, verses 22 through 23. Water doesn't have the power within its nature to allow a human being to walk on it, right? It's not a solid, it's a liquid. But Jesus, being God, can give water such a property in a particular circumstance. This doesn't disprove the law of nature that states you will sink if you try to walk on water, because water still lacks within its nature a property that would suffice to hold up a human being. Now, somebody might counter and say, well, you're misunderstanding the miracle. The miracle there would not be that water receives some new property, but that Jesus is just exercising power to suspend himself in levitation, hovering above the water, or in the case with Peter, exercising his divine power to uphold Peter. And that's possible. But if we hold to this understanding of the miracle, that the water somehow was receiving a property to uphold Peter walking on water or Jesus walking on water, the point suffices. It's not a disproving of the law. It's not disproving the inherent powers of water. So miracles don't violate the natural order created by God because they don't violate the laws of nature. They're not contrary to nature, but simply above or beyond nature. And so this is one way in which we can respond to this objection. Friends, I'm coming up on my first break. Stay tuned. You're listening to The Catholic Reason. More to come on the other side. Well, welcome back, my friends, to The Catholic Reason. I'm Dr. Carlo Broussard, staff apologist and speaker for Catholic Answers at Catholic.com and a member of the Chancery Evangelization Team here at the Diocese of Tulsa in eastern Oklahoma. In today's episode, we're looking at skeptical challenges to belief in miracles. The first of which we began to look at in our first segment of today's episode was the objection or the challenge that miracles violate the laws of nature or violate the principles of science. And since we can't give up science, we thus must give up belief in miracles. And I began to articulate one response to this challenge, and that is to say, miracles are not violations of the law, miracles do not violate the laws of nature. Once we understand miracles as wondrous effects or effects brought about by divine power beyond the powers of created natures, then it becomes clear that miracles aren't violations of the laws of nature, but rather are over and above nature. That God raises people from the dead does not disprove the law of nature that states dead people stay dead, and that inanimate matter, we're not thereby saying it now has some inherent power for it to come back to life. No, because the effect of life being given to a dead cadaver is something brought about by an external agent, namely God, and this is an effect over and above nature. And so miracles do not disprove the laws of nature. It's not saying that the principles of science are false. They're still true. They still hold, assuming that God is not acting in a particular instance. So that was the first response to this particular skeptical challenge. The second response is that the objection confuses hypothetical necessity with absolute necessity. The skeptic assumes the laws of nature are absolutely necessary. In the first segment, I quoted Baruch Spinoza and David Hume, along with Richard Dawkins. And within that objection, there's this assumption that the laws of nature are ironclad in an absolute way and that they cannot be broken, right? And that's to say the phenomena these skeptics describe must always occur no matter what. That's the underlying assumption here. Just as God can't make a square circle or make a triangle with four sides, God, even if he did exist, the skeptic would argue, could not suspend the laws of nature. Why? Because they're assuming that the laws of nature are absolutely necessary. But this is simply not true. The laws of nature have what philosophers call hypothetical necessity, which means they will hold on condition that no external cause, like God, intervenes. As the prominent Christian apologist William Lane Craig writes in his book Reasonable Faith, Christian Truth and Apologetics on page 263, natural laws are assumed to have implicit in them the assumption all things being equal. That's to say, the law states what is the case under the assumption that no other natural factors are interfering, or we could even add no other external factor, causal factor like God, is in acting in a particular instance. For example, the law of gravity tells us a rock will fall to the ground every time when I drop it. But it's not an intrinsic contradiction to imagine someone quickly catching the rock before it hits the ground. The law of gravity will hold provided nothing else happens, i.e., all things being equal. Me stopping the rock from hitting the ground doesn't disprove the law of gravity. As with the law of gravity, all laws of nature are hypothetically necessary, assuming all things being equal, not absolutely necessary. They're not inviolable in the sense that their violation, or more properly speaking, their suspension, implies a contradiction. If they were absolutely necessary, then a miracle or their suspension would entail a contradiction. Since the laws of nature are merely hypothetical, it follows the laws of nature can't preclude God's causal activity in miracles. Any denial of miracles based on the laws of nature, therefore, is unjustified. Okay, so again, the laws of nature are not absolutely necessary in the sense that something cannot both be and not be at the same time in the same respect. That's not the kind of necessity that the laws of nature have. They're hypothetically necessary. That is to say, given their natures and assuming all things equal, that God is not going to be acting to suspend the manifestation of the inherent powers of these things that the laws of nature describe, then they're going to bring about their natural effects, given their natural operations. And so that's assuming, hypothetically, on supposition, that God is not acting to suspend or bring about an effect over and above the nature of those things that the laws of nature describe. Assuming that is the case, they are necessary. They will necessarily bring about their natural effects. So once we can shed light upon the assumption of absolute necessity concerning the laws of nature, and then argue that they're not absolutely necessary, but only hypothetically necessary, then we have room for belief in miracles. So this understanding of miracles and their relation to the laws of nature dispels the myth that one has to abandon science in order to accept miracles, or to abandon miracles in order to accept science. Skeptics often pit miracles and science against each other, claiming you have to choose one over the other, but this is a false dichotomy. No choice is necessary here. We can actually adopt both. There's no need for a scientist to give up his own research that shows water has no surface tension to support a human body, because as shown, as we've talked about already, a miracle doesn't prove water has such an inherent property. The science's scientific knowledge remains secure. As such, there's no need to abandon science in order to believe in the miraculous, or to abandon the miraculous in order to keep science and its principles and laws. Okay, so that completes our responses to the first skeptical challenge, namely miracles or violations of the laws of nature. No, they're not. Another objection that modern skeptics pose to belief in miracles is that no reasonable man should believe in miracles. That's to say, as I stated earlier, belief in miracles is off limits for the wise. If you want to be an intellectually credible, sophisticated human being, then you shouldn't be believing in miracles. The assumption being that belief in miracles is unreasonable. There are two reasons skeptics give to justify this claim, and I'll deal with each in turn. The first has its origins, again, in the 18th century Scottish philosopher David Hume, who asserted that it's irrational to believe in miracles because they are rare and contradict our uniform experience. Like Hume, Skeptics base their argument on what some have called the repeatability principle. Evidence for what occurs over and over, the regular, always outweighs evidence that does not occur over and over, the rare. I'll repeat that. The repeatability principle entails evidence for what occurs over and over, the regular, always outweighs the evidence that does not. That is the rare. Now, although it's true that a wise man should base his belief on the weight of evidence, it's not true that evidence for uniform experience always outweighs evidence for what is singular and rare. And I'll give four arguments as to why we should reject Hume's repeatability principle. First, if the repeatability principle were correct, well, then we would have to reject a lot of things that we hold as true. So, for example, the Big Bang was a singular event that doesn't repeat in our experience. Have you experienced any Big Bangs lately? I'd guess the answer is no. I would also venture to say that you haven't watched anybody walk on the moon lately. Or maybe you who are listening, like myself, haven't ever watched anybody walk on the moon, right? Now, if we held to Hume's principle, it would be irrational unless you've watched the videos, etc., right? If we held to Hume's principle, it would be irrational to believe the scientific account of the Big Bang and the historical fact that Neil Armstrong walked on the moon, since these occurrences contradict our uniform experience. But of course, the Big Bang is one of the most rigorously established theories in all of science, and all who aren't conspiracy theorists believe Neil Armstrong's walk on the moon is a historical fact. The bottom line is that if we base our beliefs on what usually happens given our background knowledge, then we'll cut ourselves off from a whole lot of truth. And even if your knowledge that Neil Armstrong walked on the moon is simply based upon what you've watched, that's still basing your belief on a testimony, since you haven't seen it with your own eyes. And so you have an event that's testified to by sources that's rare and contradicts our uniform experience, because we haven't been experiencing that over and over. So if we were to follow the logic of the challenge, we would have to reject these things: the Big Bang, Neil Armstrong walking on the moon. But it's unreasonable to reject those things, and so therefore, we should reject this logic embedded in the objection. Moreover, Hume's principle nullifies science itself. Science presupposes the possibility of discovering new things that may contradict uniform experience. Scientific laws are revised all the time based on new evidence. But according to the repeatability principle, scientists would never have good grounds to consider the contrary evidence in the first place, thus ruling out revision of scientific laws altogether. But to hold such a position would negate all intellectual credibility. The very endeavor of science, the scientific enterprise, necessarily has built in within it the openness to discovering new data and thus altering current theories. But that new data, by definition, would be rare and contrary to uniform experience. And so the logic embedded in this particular skeptical challenge to belief in miracles would have us reject the whole scientific enterprise. But that's unreasonable. Friends, I'm coming up on my second break. Stay tuned. More to come to The Catholic Reason on the other side. I'm Dr. Carlo Broussard. Well, welcome back to The Catholic Reason, my friends. In today's episode, we're looking at skeptical challenges to belief in miracles. We've looked at one challenge, namely that miracles are a violation of the laws of nature, and we gave some reasons why we should reject that claim and believe that miracles are not violations of the laws of nature, that miracles are simply effects that are brought about by God over and above nature. And so we do not have to give up on the principles of science or the laws of nature in order to embrace miracles. We can hold both, embracing the principles of science, still keeping science, and at the same time, believing in miracles. Now, before our last break, we started looking at another skeptical challenge, and that is the idea that miracles are off limits for the wise, and that it's unreasonable for intellectually credible human beings to believe in miracles. One of the reasons being that our uniform experience, or the evidence for our uniform experience, always outweighs any sort of evidence for what is a rare occurrence. And given that miracles, by their very definition, are rare occurrences, then it follows that we ought not to believe it because it conflicts with and contradicts our uniform experience. But in response, I was saying, number one, that if we follow the logic of that challenge, we would have to reject a whole lot of things that we know. Two examples I gave was, you know, the knowledge of the Big Bang and knowledge that Neil Armstrong walked upon the moon. But of course, rejecting that knowledge would be unreasonable. Secondly, I argued that the logic of the challenge would lead us to reject science itself, because science, of its very nature, has a perpetual openness to discovering new data and thereby altering current theories. But that new data, by definition, is something conflicting with uniform experience. And so if we were to follow the logic of this challenge, we would have to give up on the whole scientific enterprise itself. Now, there are a couple of more answers that we, or actually a few, three more answers that we can give in response to this particular skeptical challenge that it's unreasonable to believe in miracles because uniform experience always outweighs evidence for the rare. So a third reason why Hume's argument from uniform experience fails is because it begs the question. According to Hume's view, every miracle is disqualified from the start, because every miracle is a rare event. But rarity is the essence of a miracle. A miracle, by definition, is an unusual event, something contrary to our ordinary experience and the ordinary course of things. So Hume and skeptics that follow suit can't reasonably reject a miracle because of its rarity. If they were to do so, that would be tantamount to saying, I reject a miracle because it is a miracle. That's a bit of a problem. That's begging the question, my friends, or what you might call circular reasoning. Now, a fourth critique of Hume's argument is that it commits the fallacy of special pleading, a fallacy in which one deliberately ignores aspects unfavorable to his point of view. Hume and the skeptics who are following him base his argument on his experience, or perhaps the experiences of those he knows. Perhaps there were people in Hume's time, or even people of the past, whose common experience involved miracles. This is precisely the claim of the early Christians. While Hume is within his rights to speak authoritatively about his own experience, he can't do so with regard to others. His own uniform experience can't be used to exclude the testimony of another person's experience. So Hume is claiming his uniform experience, no miracles, but the early Christians are claiming they had a uniform experience of miracles, at least for a particular point of time. And so for Hume to reject that testimony simply based on his own uniform experience, what he's doing there is he is deliberately ignoring evidence or aspects of people's testimony that's unfavorable to his point of view, namely his own skepticism. Now, finally, Hume's argument also fails because it confuses adding evidence with weighing evidence. Consider the resurrection of Jesus. Hume's principle stipulates that we simply add up the evidence of all occasions where people died and didn't rise, and use it to overwhelm the claim that Jesus rose from the dead. But all this shows is that people normally stay dead when they die, and thus that a resurrection is improbable. This is not a point of contention. Someone rising from the dead is highly improbable. But that's not the question. That's not the question of the debate. That's not what is at issue. We agree that resurrections from the dead are highly improbable. So simply adding up evidence that people stay dead when they die has no bearing on the question of whether someone actually rose from the dead, because it's very possible that someone could do so, even though it's highly improbable. We would simply have to weigh the credibility of the evidence, not simply adding up evidence and then using that mountain of evidence of people staying dead to overwhelm a testimony that says somebody rose from the dead. What the adding of the evidence of our uniform experience does do is tell us to be cautious, right? To be skeptical initially of a claim that somebody rose from the dead, which would require us to investigate it with high degrees of scrutiny in order to weigh the evidence to see whether it's credible or not. So what Hume and skeptics like him seem to overlook is that a reasonable person doesn't base his beliefs merely on odds, but on facts. So the question must be, is there sufficient evidence to justify rational belief in Jesus' resurrection, say, or any alleged miracle of the early Christian church, or any miracle for that fact? If the evidence were trustworthy, then belief in Jesus' resurrection, if we could just stick with that, would be reasonable enough, even though resurrections are highly improbable. And of course, the same line of reasoning applies to any other alleged miracle. So although the rarity of miracles may be a reason for critical investigation, as I stated a few moments ago, that doesn't mean it's unreasonable to believe in them, right? So, you know, just that we must be cautious and critical doesn't mean that it's unreasonable to adopt a miracle, assuming that the evidence for the testimony of the miracle is credible. And of course, that's where the work has to be done. Now, a skeptic may not articulate his or her skepticism about miracles based on Hume's repeatability principle, but simply might express the inability to overcome the hurdle of accepting something so improbable. A skeptic might say, well, the miracles in the Bible are just too far-fetched for me to believe. A man rising from the dead? Blind people seeing? You expect me to believe that? While I can sympathize with someone who has a healthy skepticism when it comes to improbable events, we can't reject something outright simply because it's improbable. First, an event might be improbable when considered relative to our general background knowledge, but relative to other specific knowledge or evidence, well, the improbability can decrease. For example, it's highly improbable that the winning number for the lottery here in Oklahoma would be, I don't know, 6345789, just to throw out a number. If the newspaper, however, says this is the winning number, well, then the probability changes, making the odds for it being the winning number higher. Furthermore, if the news anchor broadcast it as the winning number on the nightly news, well, then the odds for it being the winning number become even higher, right? In favor of it being the winning number. Similarly, miracles like Jesus rising from the dead are indeed improbable relative to our background knowledge. Men don't usually rise from the dead, but the improbability decreases when it's considered relative to the specific evidence, namely eyewitness testimonies. If the testimonies are sound, say of Matthew and John, who would have been eyewitnesses, and Paul himself, eyewitnesses of the resurrected Lord, well, then belief is rational, despite the event's improbability. Now, a second response to help a skeptic overcome the high hurdle of a miracle's improbability is Hume's very own principle. Again, in his An Inquiry Concerning Human Understanding, he writes this: no testimony is sufficient to establish a miracle unless the miracle be of such a kind that its falsehood be more miraculous than the fact which it endeavors to establish. Many skeptics consider only how improbable a miracle is, but hardly ever consider the improbability of a miracle not occurring despite the testimony. Take, for example, the resurrection of Jesus, to which the early Christians testified. Skeptics rightfully consider this event as improbable and are rational when they exercise caution concerning the testimonies of it. But very seldom do skeptics consider how improbable the alternative explanations are. So, for example, it's much more improbable that the early Christians stole the body and lied about the resurrection only to gain death. People don't die for what they know to be a lie when there's nothing to gain and everything to lose. Furthermore, it's highly unlikely the apostles would give simple, non-dramatic accounts, not to mention giving women the role as first eyewitnesses, if they were lying about the resurrection. Another improbable alternative to the literal resurrection of Jesus is that Christians hallucinated. It's improbable because St. Paul records Jesus appearing to many different people on several different occasions, as well as appearing to more than 500 disciples at the same time. See, and you can check out 1 Corinthians 15:6 there. These are occurrences not typical of hallucinations. So when facing the obstacle of improbability, the question shouldn't be, should I believe in miracles as such, but is there sufficient evidence to believe this or that miracle? And if the evidence for a particular miracle is trustworthy, well, then belief in that miracle would be reasonable, even though it's an improbable event. I'm coming up on my last break, friends. Stay tuned. You're listening to The Catholic Reason. Welcome back, my friends, to our last and final segment of today's episode of The Catholic Reason, where we're looking at skeptical challenges to belief in miracles. And before our last break, we were wrapping up our responses to the challenge that miracles are off limit for the wise, that a reasonable man should not believe in miracles. One reason that is often given for that claim is that our uniform experience always outweighs evidence for rare experiences. And given that miracles, by their very definition, are rare occurrences, it follows that we should stick with our uniform experience of people staying dead when they die, say, and not believing in any claim that someone rose from the dead, like Jesus' resurrection. And then we gave some reasons as to why we can reject that sort of reasoning. And we offered five responses to that version of the argument. But there's another reason that skeptics give as to why it's unreasonable to believe. It's not fitting for a reasonable man to believe in miracles, and that is because miracles are just too improbable to believe. And of course, we gave a couple of responses to that, one of which is that improbability increases, or the improbability of a miracle might be high relative to our general background knowledge, but relative to specific knowledge, when you start looking at the testimonies and arriving at the conclusion that they are indeed credible, then the improbability decreases, thereby giving permission, say, to reason to embrace the testimony that a miracle has occurred. And then, as I was pointing out before our last break, we can appeal to Hume's principle itself that if the denial of the miraculous fact is more miraculous, well, then it seemingly would be reasonable to adopt the miraculous testimony, to believe in the testimony about the miracle if the alternative explanation is even more miraculous. And so, as I was pointing out, skeptics often fail to consider the higher improbability of the alternative explanations to the miraculous testimony. So in the case of Jesus' resurrection, it's even more improbable to think that the apostles would have lied about the resurrection, given that they had nothing to gain and everything to lose. It's even more improbable to think that the early Christians were hallucinating, given the fact that they were with Jesus many different times on several different occasions, and Jesus appearing to over 500 people at the same time. So when faced with the obstacle of improbability, as I pointed out before the last break, the question shouldn't be, should I believe in miracles as such, but is there sufficient evidence to believe this or that miracle? And if the evidence for a particular miracle is trustworthy, then belief in that miracle would be reasonable, even though it's an improbable event. The wise man surely needs to exercise caution when confronted with accounts of the miraculous. But the wise man should also be open to following the evidence where it leads, no matter how extraordinary and improbable it is. Okay, so there's one more objection that I want to consider in today's episode before we close it out here. Many skeptics assert that the early Christians believe in the miracles because their culture was a primitive pre-scientific culture where people were ignorant of the course of nature. This being the case, so it's argued, they weren't able to perceive a miracle as being contrary to nature and thus readily accepted miraculous claims. For instance, in his work, again, An Inquiry Concerning Human Understanding, David Hume argues for a strong presumption against the supernatural and miraculous based on the idea that miracles, quote, chiefly abound among ignorant and barbarous nations. Now, there are three ways to respond to this claim. First, consider St. Joseph's decision to divorce Mary. His plan to divorce Mary quietly when she turned up pregnant showed he knew as well as any modern gynecologist that in the ordinary course of nature, women don't have babies without having sexual relations with a man. It's only after the angel appeared to him and told him the baby was of the Holy Spirit that he took Mary in. As C.S. Lewis writes in his book Miracles, when St. Joseph finally accepted the view that his fiancée's pregnancy was due not to unchastity, but to a miracle, he accepted the miracle as something contrary to the known order of nature, right? He knew the course of nature about how children are conceived. And so it's not that he was ignorant of the course of nature that led him to believe in the miracle. It was precisely because of his knowledge of the course of nature that he believed the miracle. It's unreasonable to believe Joseph wouldn't have known that it's contrary to the course of nature for a virgin to have a child. And what I mean by contrary, I'm not meaning violating or disproving the laws of nature, but simply something that is contrary to the uniform experience. Second, the early Christians' testimony about miracles itself necessarily implies they understood the laws of nature. How can one recognize something as a miracle or an extraordinary event or occurrence unless one already knows what is ordinary? The Gospels speak of the audiences responding with fear and awe to Jesus' marvelous deeds, for example. Mark 6:2, Mark 6:51, Mark 7:37, Luke 5:26, and 7:16. Here's the question. Why would they have this reaction unless they recognize that such deeds were contrary to the ordinary course of nature? Again, C.S. Lewis notes in his book Miracles, pages 74 to 75, if they were not known to be contrary to the laws of nature, how could they suggest the presence of the supernatural? How could they be surprising unless they were seen to be exceptions to the rules? And how can anything be seen to be an exception until the rules are known? The bottom line is that if the early Christians didn't know the basic laws of nature, they would have no idea of what constitutes a miracle. And consequently, such events would in no way pique their interest. And so this is yet another reason to reject this objection. Third, the doubt of the miraculous embedded in the gospel narratives is another example that disproves the early Christians accepted miracles because they were pre-scientific people. Take, for example, St. Luke's narrative of Zechariah's encounter with the angel there in Luke 1:18. Zechariah, who was a priest and thus a religious man, refused to believe the angel's announcement that his wife Elizabeth would conceive a son. Why have such doubt? Well, the answer is because Elizabeth was beyond childbearing years. Zechariah knew that conception of a child at such an old age would run counter to the uniform experience of the laws of nature. This is precisely the reason why he initially refused to believe the miracle. St. Luke makes it evident that first century Jews were not so unaware of the laws of nature that they were prepared to believe any sort of miraculous claim. St. Luke's narrative of the resurrection serves as another example. That is to say, where people are doubting the miraculous claim. According to Luke, the first ones to oppose the Christian message of the resurrection were not atheists, but the Sadducees, the high priests. And you could check out Acts 4:1 through 24. They were God-fearing Jews and the religious leaders of the day. If they were unaware that dead men stay dead, well, then why did they reject the Christian confession of the resurrection of Jesus? We also see doubt concerning the resurrection in the other Gospels. Mark recounts the apostles doubting the resurrection on two different occasions. And you can check out Mark 16:9 through 13 for that. According to Matthew, some of the apostles doubted when Jesus appeared on the mountain in Galilee, right before his ascension, according to Matthew 28:16 through 17. And finally, St. John records how Thomas doubted and wouldn't believe unless he saw the risen Jesus. Remember John 20:25, unless I see in his hands, Thomas says, the print of the nails, and place my finger in the mark of the nails, and place my hand in his side, I will not believe. So there's ample evidence that, contrary to the skeptics' assertion, the people of the first century Judaism were far from ignorant of the ordinary course of nature. The idea that the early Christians believed miracles because they were pre-scientific is simply unfounded. We have evidence to the contrary. They had sufficient knowledge, sufficient scientific knowledge of the laws of nature and the normal course of nature that would allow for them to accurately recognize something that was of a miraculous nature. So, we've provided, I think, there are some sufficient responses to this particular objection that the early Christians were pre-scientific. Well, my friends, that's all the time that we have for this week's episode of The Catholic Reason. My claim today was that the challenges to belief in miracles that we covered fail to justify a rejection of belief in miracles. Miracles do not violate the laws of nature. Miracles, and the reason being is because miracles are effects that are brought about by God, a causal agent outside of nature, and these effects are over and above nature, not violations of the nature of things, and thus violations of the laws of nature, which are shorthand descriptions of the natures of things and their inherent properties and dispositions and capacities. Secondly, miracles are not off limits for the rational or reasonable man, because if the evidence is credible, then it's reasonable to accept that testimony for the miraculous. And thirdly, the early Christians weren't so primitive that they wouldn't be able to recognize a legit miracle. You don't need the knowledge of modern science to recognize a virginal conception and a resurrection from the dead. So my friends, thanks for listening to The Catholic Reason, a production of St. Michael Catholic Radio, based here in Broken Arrow, Oklahoma. Remember, you can download the show through whichever podcast platform you use by subscribing to the Eastern Oklahoma Catholic Podcast. You can also access the archived episodes at my website, CarloBrusard.com, under the audio tab. I invite you to join me again next time for The Catholic Reason as we continue looking at Catholic claims and the reasons behind them. Tell a friend. I'll talk to you then. God bless.